Gas prices are falling and our expectations are rising for extra cash in our pockets.
How confident are consumers going to be that they're going to be having access to cheap gasoline for an extended period of time?
We take advantage of every opportunity we have in order to meet the needs of our students and fund something that otherwise we couldn't.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, how are efforts going to get Arizonans signed up for health care?
A different and more literary perspective on the state.
Arizona companies begin acting as official forces for good.
And we take a hike in search of something special.
It's the kind of tree that you're going to bring home and it's going to look kind of funky, but you're going to say, hey, man, I cut this myself.
Plus, what's better than the worst movie ever made? A comic book about the worst movie ever made.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today will clear out a bit, and by tonight, skies will be totally clear, we expect, with lows in the mid-40s. Then for tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, with highs back into the mid-60s. For some of us who've lived here a long time, it's a chilly afternoon. It's partly cloudy and 59 degrees.
Arizona's unemployment rate remained unchanged last month after 2 months of slight decreases. State Department of Administration economists say the state's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate for November was 6.8%, the same as October. It was 6.9% in September. The national unemployment rate also remained unchanged in November at 5.8%. The department says 9 of the state's 11 major sectors added jobs, 2 reported losses over the month. Arizona added 24,400 non-farm jobs in November, with most of them in the private sector. Losses were primarily in construction and manufacturing, which shed a combined 1,100 jobs.
Travelers crossing the U.S.-Mexico border will now have access to wait time data at all Arizona ports. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, it's part of a new app released by U.S. Customs and Border Protection this week.
What's known as the Border Wait Time app allows travelers to find and compare wait times at the 3 ports of entry closest to them. The program provides users with data from all land border crossings with Mexico and Canada. Edith Serrano is with CBP's Tucson office. She says the agency hopes the app will boost efficiency for Homeland Security agents and travelers over the holiday season.
As they're returning, they can use their application to see what the wait times are for that particular port where they're crossing. They can see how many lanes are open, and by gauging at that, it would assist them to maybe plan their travel accordingly.
Serrano says the app is free and does not require users to register or provide any personal information. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is expected to be a near-record year for holiday travel in Arizona. AAA spokeswoman Michelle Donati says the low price of gas has led to a major increase in people planning to travel over the holidays.
Almost 2 million Arizonans will be taking a trip 50 or more miles from home. That's an increase of almost 3% from last year. 90% of those will be taking a road trip. That's up 3% over last year.
Donati says nearly 100 million people across the country will be hitting the roads over the holidays, making this the highest travel volume on record across the U.S. It'll be the second highest volume on record for Arizona. The statewide average price of gas this morning is $2.41 a gallon, down 15 cents a gallon from a week ago at this time. More on the story coming up on the show.
Over the last decade, Arizona has developed a reputation as a laboratory for anti-illegal immigration laws, but many of these laws haven't survived legal scrutiny, and there's been a flurry of changes in just the last few days. Just today, the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office announced it'll soon disband a controversial unit that arrests unauthorized immigrants for working with fake IDs. Joining me now to talk about the latest is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, hi.
Hi there.
Now, you cover immigration issues for the station. We sometimes even joke your stories about legal challenges to Arizona laws sometimes sound repetitive.
Yeah, I mean, I've lost count of how many times I've written a host intro that says something like, federal court says Arizona immigration law is unconstitutional. You know, we talk a lot about SB 1070, but there are other Arizona immigration-related laws passed before or after SB 1070, and we've seen those run into trouble in the courts lately, too.
So fill us in on some of these more recent losses for Arizona.
Just yesterday, we found out that Arizona will have to give Dreamers driver's licenses. We also found out a couple weeks ago that Arizona's practice of holding immigrants who are charged with felonies without bail is unconstitutional, and they've had to start bail hearings in local courts. And the 2005 Arizona anti-human smuggling law was recently struck down in November.
Now let's turn to today's news that the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office will no longer do work-related ID theft cases and is disbanding the unit. This happened after the immigrant rights group Puente sued the sheriff this summer. Jude, explain to us how that enforcement worked, why it's a big deal the sheriff says he's going to stop.
So all over the country, unauthorized immigrants work without proper papers in order to get jobs, and it's usually up to the federal government to prosecute them for doing that. But in 2007 and 2008, the Arizona legislature passed laws that made it easier to prosecute people for working with someone else's ID, and they could prosecute them with state felony charges for ID theft and forgery. So that really enabled this whole new category of ways to charge immigrants with felonies for being here illegally, even though that's normally the federal domain. And that was really the last tool that Arpaio had to use state laws to go after immigrants. And so that's why it's really significant that that he's no longer using this unit.
Finally, to what extent does this feel like the end of an era? Because a lot of the politicians, elected officials who were identified with anti-illegal immigration legislation, Governor Jan Brewer, Attorney General Tom Horn, are leaving office very soon. And even Russell Pierce, of course, has been out of the limelight for a while.
Right. Not to mention that former Maricopa County Attorney Andy Thomas, who thought up many of the ways to use these state laws to criminalize immigrant-related activity, was disbarred for another matter. And Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who's become a national figure in local anti-immigration enforcement, is now under the control of a federal judge and a court-appointed monitor for racial profiling. So we're seeing a lot of changes.
KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
OPEC hasn't exactly been a beloved organization or cartel at any point in its existence. But late last week, the head of OPEC said he's not worried about oil prices sinking to $40 a barrel, which has also led to gas prices dropping to below $2.50 a gallon. He says he'll let market forces determine what's next. But what does that mean? Dennis Hoffman of the W.P. Carey School at ASU says it's a strategic move.
Now, what they're saying is that they don't have any current plans to change their production levels. And they're going to let the market then, they're going to let demand kind of take care of itself in comparison with current production levels. And the challenge for oil is that current demand is now short, falling short of the production levels that are taking place in the world. And some of that's coming from China. Some of it's coming from Europe. And of course, on the supply side, you've got the United States producing a significant amount of oil now that it certainly did not take place back in the 70s when many of us old guys remember, you know, the first round of energy shocks. It is an interesting play. I remember hearing Boone Pickens, mm-hmm. and this was about 6 weeks ago when he was asked to speculate on what OPEC would do. He said, well, it's hard to know. They could curtail supply and kind of put a floor under price, or they could just let it go and effectively say to these new investors in the United States that are involved in fracking, hey, you fracker boys, how do you like this low price, you know?
Is it possible that some of this play by OPEC is this idea that, as you said, they can ride it out, but some of the fracker boys, as you said, can't, and then maybe in a year we'll see oil popping right back up again to $80, $90, $100 a barrel?
Correct. And oil has had this pattern. I mean, if you look at longer-term oil and gasoline prices, they do exhibit wild fluctuations from time to time, but rarely do they stay low for an extended period of time.
Dennis, what are you watching as far as consumer behavior is concerned?
The real issue here is how confident are consumers going to be that they're going to be having access to cheap gasoline for an extended period of time? Because if it's just ephemeral, if this is just a week or two or a month or two, you know, you probably don't see much in the way of changes in consumption patterns. On the other hand, if it were to be a year of low gasoline prices, so just thinking about the consumer and the family consumer and just thinking about the fuel that goes in the family car, current gasoline prices have delivered something on the order of $2 to $2.5 billion of an additional disposable income to Arizona consumers if this were to last for a year. I would be saying very different things should I be talking about North Dakota or Texas or something like that. There are certainly the oil-producing states are going to suffer from this. You know, this is happening around the holiday season. I suspect it'll provide a little bit of a catalyst even to retail sales over the holidays.
Economist Dennis Hoffman of the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU.
Those gas prices are also good news for school districts. Bobette Sylvester, Mesa Public Schools Assistant Superintendent for Business and Support Services, says the district has a huge fleet, including maintenance vehicles and buses that run on both diesel and propane.
We spend about $3.5 million in fuel costs a year, and that's broken down between regular fuel, which is what we would call our white fleet, which is our maintenance vehicles, our vans, and those type of vehicles. We also have diesel buses. We have almost a bus fleet of about 500 buses. And we bought 70 propane buses. And propane is a much cleaner, much more affordable fuel source. And we were able to lower our gas costs or our fuel total fuel costs by $300,000 last year, an 8% decrease.
Have you noticed that your fuel costs have gone down over the past several weeks as gas costs have gone down?
You know, we have noticed a trend, and you have to remember is that we don't use fueling stations. We have our own tanks. And so when we will see that cost implication is the next time we fuel up those tanks. But at that time, certainly, we will see the price decrease. You know, I was looking at some market prices, and we can anticipate anywhere between an 18 to 24% reduction in costs. Now, if that were to hold over a full year, which I think might be difficult, but if it were to hold over a full year, we would see upwards of a $640,000 savings in fuel costs.
So what do you do with that extra money then?
You know, certainly in the budget for Arizona schools, any savings is always greatly appreciated, and it's usually absorbed back into the budget to meet other needs of the schools, whether it be textbooks, technology, usually reserved for one-time items, because we can't anticipate that savings will always be there. So we'll keep our budgets similar, but certainly the savings will be absorbed in other one-time capital needs that we need to purchase.
Has there been any talk about potentially filling up your tanks perhaps a little early to take advantage of the fact that prices are where they are as opposed to maybe waiting and risking them go back up again?
You know, certainly we look at those factors, and we also look at the cost of bringing them in to fill the tanks. And so if the fees can be absorbed and still have the cost savings of doing a midpoint fill-up, we'll certainly look at that and do that.
Would you consider this an unexpected, I don't want to call it a windfall, but an unexpected amount of money that you maybe weren't counting on and didn't expect to have?
Well, I think that you have to consider that the $600,000 figure is really if the fuel cost stayed at that depressed value for an entire year. So a one-month look period would be more about, less than $60,000. And so I wouldn't necessarily call that a windfall, but I certainly do call it an opportunity. And we take advantage of every opportunity we have in order to meet the needs of our students and fund something that otherwise we couldn't.
Given the fact that school budgets and state funding for schools are what they are, how important is it that you're able to realize whatever potential savings from fuel that you're able to get, whether it be a month or two or over several months or even a year?
It's incredibly important. With the lack of capital funding, districts are having to get incredibly creative. One, they're putting off needs that they have. Two, they're getting incredibly creative in how to still provide the needs for our students in a different manner. And then three, we've had to look to our local communities to support us in some of those capital needs.
Bobette Sylvester is Assistant Superintendent for Business and Support Services with Mesa Public Schools. We're between deadlines to sign up for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The next one is February 15th, when the open enrollment period ends. That means groups are out and about across the state trying to get people on board. One of those groups is the People of Color Network. Tomas León is its president and CEO.
The second time around, there's most definitely a heightened awareness and interest and a lot more specific questions that are emerging around cost and enrollment process and tax and premium assistance. And so we had to do a lot more outreach and engagement last go around just to raise awareness. And this time we've got a lot of interest and traffic going to our website, to our telephone line, and requesting assistance. So
people tended to know more that, hey, this healthcare law is a thing and we need more details about it, as opposed to what's this healthcare law?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right on. I mean, the first time around, I was like, well, what is this and what is it about? And this time is, well, we know that there's an open enrollment for people who are uninsured or underinsured, and so they want to know more specifics.
So what are the kinds of questions that your navigators heard from folks that they approached and talked about trying to get enrolled?
Well, again, they surround mostly cost and enrollment and tax and premium assistant help. And so some of the top five, the number one is, I'm uninsured. Am I required to get coverage in 2014? Again, awareness was built and some education around that. This time people started hearing stories and more information that there was a penalty if you're uninsured and you don't get coverage. The second is, what is the penalty if I don't have coverage? So people want to know, well, what's my penalty if I don't get the coverage?
There was a lot of talk the first go-around about this population of so-called young invincibles, of younger people who figured, I'm not sick now, I don't need health insurance, why should I bother paying for it? Did you come across those folks this go-around? And if so, what kinds of conversations did you have with them?
Yeah, that was a really challenging group of people to reach and educate. And through Cover Arizona, the coalition, we partnered with other organizations that were dedicated to reaching invincibles. And so, they're more aware that they have a responsibility and there's a penalty associated with that. But more importantly, conversations that are taking place is, what are the benefits of having health insurance coverage?
Did you have an easier time trying to get them to enroll this time than last?
We're we're halfway into the enrollment period and process. It's much improved from the last enrollment period, so we have better traction this time, and we're spending a lot more time educating folks about the benefits and the process. So
did you have goals leading into this open enrollment period of how many people you would like to enroll or the kinds of people that you would like to get enrolled?
Yeah, we did have some goals. Our goal as a diverse coalition, our goal was to outreach to the Hispanic community, Native American, the Asian, the African American community to really ensure that they had access to coverage, because often that leads to health disparities. And so when you don't have coverage, you don't get access to care, whether it's physical or behavioral health. And so we wanted to ensure that these the low-income, diverse populations had access to coverage so that we can get them connected to care. And so that was a goal of ours, and we're dedicating more outreach and engagement to reach those different diverse populations. And we're well on our way with our broad, diverse coalition to be able to have the capacity to do that kind of outreach.
Tomas León is president and CEO of the People of Color Network. Tomas, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
The word sprawl has negative connotations in the Valley, but a new online magazine wants to change that.
To reclaim it in a way and to really think about how it impacts us on a much deeper level.
Redefining sprawl, coming up on the show. Good afternoon. It's 2:22 and you're listening to 91.5 KJZZ. Not much going on in Valley traffic yet this afternoon, but one accident causing a little bit of a backup. It's I-17 northbound at Glendale. It's blocking the right lane. Valley weather for tonight, we will clear out. and have some cool overnight temperatures in the lower to mid-40s. Should be partly to mostly sunny for tomorrow with a high near 65, back into the upper 60s by the weekend. Currently, relative humidity is at 55%. It's partly cloudy and 59 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by the Heard Museum, where the exhibit Beautiful Games, American Indian Sport and Art opens December 20th. Learn how many contemporary sports are rooted in traditional tribal games. Details at heard.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein.
It seems morning TV is always trying to help us all out with our marriages, keeping us together. George and Robin Roberts help us. Al Roker, forget the weather. Am I going to stay married? Good Morning America to the rescue.
With the divorce rate at 50% and climbing, maybe we should all read this essay written by two relationship therapists who proclaim it's conscious uncoupling that prevents families from being broken by divorce.
The conscious uncoupling of Gwyneth Paltrow. It sounds like a Milan Kundera novel. The whole divorce is inevitable notion is a complete myth, you know. Fiction. Divorce has been on the decline for the last 30 years. If you got married in the 90s, folks, you have a high chance of staying together. Surely the influence of all that Dr. Dre, Radiohead, Green Day, and Guns N' Roses. So what we played at my wedding, 1995, folks. It's a big party. You should have been there. Justin Wolfers probably has a different theory about all this, though. He's professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
John, it's great to be here.
So I saw these numbers on the New York Times, and it came off the most emailed list where it quickly rose to the top with a bullet, as you might expect. Where do these numbers come from?
So there's a bunch of different ways of measuring divorce. The first thing is anytime someone gets divorced, there's a divorce certificate on file at the county courthouse. And so you could count all the divorce certificates. And there's a lot fewer divorce certificates being issued today than there were 30 years ago. Another thing you can do is interview people and ask them about their marital histories. You know, when did you get married? When did you get divorced? And from that, we can figure out how many people got divorced each year. That also tells us the divorce rate's been declining for 30 years.
And the peak was in the 80s?
Peak was, depending how you, which data source you look at it, you know, 79, 80, 81, sometime around then.
And do you have a sort of weighted average on what is the, you know, is it a magic 7 or 14-year itch or 20 is a tough year? Because, you know, there's an argument to be made that the people who got married in the 90s, it may be a little early yet to be claiming that they're together for all time.
Yeah, you should always be a little worried about some of the stories, indeed myths you hear about things like a 7-year itch. Marriages are actually most likely to break up soon after they form. So the first 2 years are actually the most likely to result in separation. And then the chances of divorce decline every year that you remain married after that. So, John, you've survived since 95. I'd say you're looking pretty good, mate.
I'm looking pretty good, yeah. And in that those first couple of years, that's the well-known Kardashian effect, right?
Yeah. You know, sometimes you wake up, you discover you made a mistake. Sometimes you grow up, you discover that you made a mistake. But people are doing less of that now. I think part of the story is, in fact, people are waiting longer to get married. You know, back in the days when you were getting married at 19, 20, 21, it's impossible to believe that you'd be able to figure out the right partner for who you were going to be when you grew up, you know, in your 40s and 50s. Today, people are delaying marriage to their mid to late 20s, often in their 30s. And we're seeing a lot more stable marriages as a result.
Is there any aspect of this that there's a disincentive to get divorced, that people who have gotten divorced find themselves miserable, unlike Louis C.K., who finds apparent happiness in divorce being free? I mean, is there a case of where divorces really do fall apart, where the idea of splitting up actually becomes a very dreadful idea in the out years?
The way it works is... The year that people get divorced is often one of the least happy of their lives. So a lot of people look at that and they say, well, therefore, divorce must be a bad thing if it makes people unhappy. But what you see, actually, is that, you know, when you get married, you're really happy. Happiness tends to decline a bit as the marriage continues. And among those people who do get divorced, you see their happiness declining right up to the point of divorce. And then in the years after, actually, their happiness recovers. suggesting, you know, maybe this is a good choice for the people who go ahead and make it, that life, in fact, does get better, even if it doesn't feel that way when you're in the middle of it.
So why does the, I mean, I guess, you know, everybody loves to say that the media distorts everything and keeps myths around that need to go away. But why do you think there is this, you know, gut level sense that you're rolling the dice when you get married, even though the statistics say, no, in fact, you're much more likely to stay together. You shouldn't worry so much.
Well, you know, by many measures, there's still a reasonable chance that many people will end up divorced. You know, maybe it's closer to 1 in 3 than it is to 1 in 2. That's still enough to worry a lot of people. But, you know, marriage and divorce is one of those incredibly politically contentious issues. And so I think, you know, advocates on both sides who want to argue that the sky is falling in order to bring greater attention to how they want to reinvent families and marriage have a great incentive to make us think that this institution is declining. It's not declining, but it is definitely adapting. Marriage today is very different to what marriage meant 30, 40 years ago.
And there's an even broader study to be done here in the sense that the kinds of relationships that are stable and that constitute a, you know, what we would have called back in the 50s a nuclear family, they're becoming more diverse. I mean, there's people who are gay, who are straight, who are married. There are people who are not married but who are together. There are, you know, adoptive families that have all kinds of different, you know, non-sacred sorts of bonds to them that have grown up with this statistic of declining divorces. Yes?
Absolutely. So American family life looks a lot more varied than it once did. But even among those who in the statistics look like traditional nuclear families, you know, mum and dad and two kids, their family life is very different today. You know, in the 1950s and 60s, you know, dad's job was to go to work and mum's was to stay at home. In that sort of a marriage where people were operating in completely separate spheres, there was very much an opposites attract marriage. You know, mum wanted to find the best wage earner she could find and dad wanted to find the best homemaker he could find, and they didn't necessarily have a lot in common. What we've seen, though, is as marriage has changed and women have moved into the workforce and more opportunities have opened up, is marriage has adapted. Marriage today is very much less about mum and dad playing different and specialized roles. Instead, it's about shared passions. You know, an economist would call it consumption complementarities, and someone a bit more romantic would call it love. You know, the soulmate marriage is a very recent thing. And that's, you know, today when you see nuclear families like that, it's very different than their parents or their grandparents who were together for quite different reasons.
And what kind of kids come out of that before we go?
You know, I think that's very much an open question. You know,
yeah,
we
yeah,
can
yeah,
see...
Yeah, yeah. Professor dodging the question. That's a, that's an open
that's
question.
That's exactly what I'm
it's
doing,
an open
mate.
Question as you're dodging me. Okay, so are you married?
I have been with my partner for many, many years, but we are not formally married.
Many, many years? Does she know the actual number? Or he?
Even I know the actual number, mate. It's 17.
All right. Justin Wolfers, thanks so much. Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of Michigan and Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Jacob Hoffling. I'm a senior at Arizona State University, and we are singing Christmas hymns today as part of the Carillon Hymn Sing.
I'm Carl Cross, and I'm the co-director of the ASU Symphony Carillon Society. Carillon has 258 bells, which is the largest of its kind in this country.
I've been involved with the Carillon for the past 3 years. I'm an organ student here, so in fact I'd never even heard of a Carillon until I applied for the scholarship position, and that was a great opportunity to figure out how to play. I really liked the songs that are about bells. It's perfectly fitting for this instrument.
That's ASU student Jacob Hoffling and Carillon Society co-chair Carl Cross at the 8th Annual Christmas Carol Sing-Along at Old Main on the Tempe campus. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, just want to tell us how out of tune we are, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. Good afternoon. It's the show with Mark. I'm Steve, updating Valley traffic at this hour. An accident just in over the past couple of minutes. It's on the 51 southbound at Union Hills, and that collision's blocking the HOV lane. Meanwhile, I-17 northbound, a couple of collisions, one at Glendale. That's blocking the right lane. The other at Camelback. Be careful in that area. That one's blocking three lanes. Valley weather for tonight. We will clear out those clouds and have lows in the lower to mid-40s. Should be partly to mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 63. Bundle up if you go outside right now, though. It's only 59 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Goodwill of Central Arizona. Donating to Goodwill through the charitable tax credit helps put people in our community to work. You can learn more from your tax advisor or give online at goodwilltaxcredit.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Additional U.S. troops will start moving into Iraq in the next couple of weeks to train local forces. But the top U.S. commander overseeing operations there says it will take at least 3 years to build the capabilities of the Iraqi military. U.S. Army Lieutenant General James Terry says the goal is to get the Iraqi units trained and back in the fight against the so-called Islamic State militants. And he says the U.S. isn't alone in helping the Iraqis, with around 40 nations joining the effort.
Various countries will contribute national capabilities on different timelines. The strength of this team is in our common purpose, and what unites us is a strong resolve to combat this threat.
Terry says hundreds of additional troops are expected to deploy soon, joining around 1,700 troops there now. The white supremacist accused of killing three people at Jewish facilities near Kansas City earlier this year could face the death penalty. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports on Fraser Glenn Miller's competency hearing.
A judge who ordered a mental evaluation of Fraser Glenn Miller has ruled that he is fit to stand trial. The Johnson County, Kansas prosecutor says he'll seek the death penalty. But Miller's health may already be failing. He's 74 and has emphysema. He told the Kansas City Star that he wanted to, quote, kill some Jews before he died. Miller didn't wind up doing that. In the attack last April, he allegedly murdered three people outside a Jewish community center and an assisted living facility in suburban Kansas City, all of them Christians. Miller is a neo-Nazi who ran a violent Klan group in the 1980s, was arrested on weapons charges, testified against his colleagues, and entered the Witness Protection Program. Miller's murder trial is scheduled to start this spring. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
Wall Street sharply higher by the closing bell today. The Dow up 421 points at 17,778. That's up almost 2.5%. This is NPR.
Starting on January 2nd, Arizona businesses will be able to register as benefit corporations, meaning, as the old saying goes, they try to do well by doing good. Arizona lawmakers approved the new classification last year. Courtney Klein, co-founder of the nonprofit incubator SeedSpot, was one of the measure's main proponents.
We really hope that this becomes a growing movement, that more companies begin to pay attention to what it means to do good in the world and what it means to make a profit, and that they look at the benefit corporation statutes as an option to protect the integrity of both of those things.
There are more than 20 states that have passed benefit corporation laws, including all of Arizona's neighbors other than New Mexico. Klein says many investors now are looking for more than just financial returns.
And there's this whole movement taking shape now of impact investors looking for companies like this that have the duality of both benefits. And so we're really proud of the fact that Arizona can now say, we're growing those companies here. We do have benefit corporations that are taking shape in Arizona, and we hope that the investment dollars follow.
Klein says she knows of around 10 companies that'll be ready to go when the law becomes effective the day after New Year's. One of them is Goodman's Interior Structures. Adam Goodman is the firm's CEO and its third-generation owner.
The paperwork is submitted. Come January 2nd, we will become a certified B Corporation in Arizona.
So what's in it for you to do that?
There's nothing in it for us, right? That's sort of the whole premise of the concept, is that we're about others, that we're about our community, we're about our people, we're about the environment. That's the philosophy we've had as a business for 60 years. And so there's nothing in it for us to become a B Corporation other than an acknowledgement from an outside entity that what we're doing is the right thing. And it's really a validation that we can point to our employees and prospective employees that were the right company to work for.
You guys have been doing stuff like this for a while, though. I mean, when you walk in, right on the wall there is a whole sort of a credo about how, you know, this company aims to make the community and the world a better place. So I guess what will change once you officially become a B Corporation?
Nothing will change once we become a B Corporation. Our customers still expect us to be competitive, to do the right thing, the right price, on time, and all that, and great design. It's really just simply a validation for our own employees and prospective employees. And there's no other outside benefits. We're not expecting any kind of accolades or any kind of attention other than this nice piece on KJZZ.
Do you expect more companies to start doing this kind of stuff since they can get this recognition, people who maybe weren't doing it before?
I think more and more companies and executives are becoming enlightened to the fact that if you want to attract the very best talent, you're going to have to give people a reason to come to work every day. And there's got to be something that's a little bit more inspiring, something that's about something that's bigger than themselves. We sell office furniture. Yes, that's true. It's not in and of itself particularly inspiring, but when we can give our people a greater reason, a greater purpose for existing and coming to work every day, then we've done something meaningful.
What do you think it'll mean for the state to have this classification? And as you say, potentially more executives looking to become part of this.
I love thinking about the analogy of what Silicon Valley is to the tech industry that Arizona can become for purpose-based businesses. If we can attract more and more and inspire other companies to really find their own purpose and help their employees become about something bigger than themselves. And I think that can be a very a vibrant and engaged business community that could really be pretty special.
Do you find that your customers look to that sort of thing when they're looking where they're going to buy their furniture? I mean, are they looking for a company that sort of does something more than just what they produce and sell? Or are they just looking for best price, most convenient, things like that?
I'd say our customers appreciate the fact that we have a responsible outlook on the community and the environment and our people. I would say our prospective customers, not so much. Our prospective customers really want to make sure that we're the right partner for them to the right supplier, that we can provide great designs on time and accurate. And it's a nice bonus that we take good care of the community, the environment, and our people.
Do you use that in your advertising? I mean, do you plan to use the fact that you'll be a benefits corporation in your advertising and your marketing?
We're going to use the B Corp status to attract employees, not so much customers. I really don't think that's what the customers are looking for, but absolutely to attract employees.
Adam Goodman, CEO of Goodman's Interior Structures, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And by way of full disclosure, Goodman's is an underwriter of KJZZ. The word sprawl isn't typically used in a positive way, especially around the valley, where it's used to describe uncontrolled development into the desert. Daniel Mills, a recent ASU grad, is attempting to flip that definition on its head with the new online magazine Sprawler. He and other writers want to help change the perception of Arizona as an intolerant and controversial place. Daniel, sprawl is a word that brings about multiple thoughts, sometimes contradictory thoughts. So what were you aiming for with the name Sprawler?
Since Sprawler is a publication that is meant to dig deeper into the identity of Arizona and what it means to live in Arizona, I thought there is nothing that represents Arizona more than sprawl. Traditionally, we think of ourselves as cowboys. We are influenced by the stories of Lone Rangers and Native Americans, and so that has really defined us for a long time. But I think this characteristic of sprawl and how we have built ourselves and how we have changed our landscape has impacted us so much and impacts our daily lives so much that we cannot think about what it means to live in Arizona without incorporating that. And so Sprawler, the name, is an effort to involve that more in the conversation, to reclaim it in a way, and to really think about how it impacts us on a much deeper level.
Do you think that there's a perception of Arizona as being a certain way that maybe Sprawler can twist that on its head a little bit and change how people perceive it?
Absolutely. People who live here and people who live outside of Arizona are equally guilty of being very quick to jump on any opportunity to fulfill this belief we have that Arizona is just the butt end of a joke and can't be taken very seriously in many regards. I do hope to change that, and with the stories on Sprawler, we are covering topics that I think to be important, and we will be covering them with a more serious and critical tone. But at the same time, Arizona is not just going to be a whipping boy in our publication. We really do hope to offer some insight and some advice to some more problems that we see.
It sounds like you know what it means to be a journalist and get out stories that people aren't hearing and tell them in an important and also interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, a lot of people are saying these days it's tough to get people to actually, with the attention span, to actually sit down and read a story of depth.
Mm-hmm.
Does that concern you at all?
No, it doesn't, because I think it's a little of the question of the chicken or the egg. So much of what we read nowadays and so many of the publications that are coming out and being created online cater to an audience that only want a short read, that most of them operate with an ad-based model. So what most people don't realize is when you go to a website to read an article, chances are they're really trying to just get you to click through pages. That has influenced journalism and online media so much. And since online media really is a very, very young industry, there is so much more room open to experimentation and to show people what is possible. I think that when you provide people with quality content on important topics, they see the benefit in that, and they can distinguish between one and the other.
Daniel Mills is the creative force behind Sprawler. Daniel, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
In today's globalized economy, billions of tons of cargo are shipped across oceans from Asia to the rest of the world. But it's not a new trade. For more than 2,000 years, ships have carried silks, spices, tea, and ceramics along the maritime Silk Road. It could be a perilous voyage, especially when storms hit. Seeking shelter on their way to or from China, many would hug the 800-mile coast of Vietnam.
Archaeologists say evidence of these early global capitalists lies unexplored in wrecks on the seabed, but they're warning that Vietnam is ill-equipped to safeguard this heritage and that treasure hunters are getting there first.
The BBC's Samantha Disanayake reports from the Cham Islands in Vietnam.
And when he died, he found
that one.
Yeah, okay. That's one.
So we'd like to go where he died for that one.
Mark Staniforth is searching for a shipwreck. He's come to meet some fishermen who've not just been catching fish. They've also netted curious pieces of pottery.
We'd like to see it.
So the fisherman's going to take us on the boat?
On the boat and go to where he found that individual piece. And we're going to try and dive there and see if there's anything else there.
We're in the middle of a small fishing village on the island of Koh Lao Cham. And in front of me, a very calm, restful port with clear emerald waters and wooden fishing boats bobbing up and down. But for 3,000 years, there have also been furious typhoons which have wrecked probably hundreds of ships. All along this stretch of Vietnam's long coastline, archaeologists believe, are the remains of many more unlucky merchant ships. Through these waters for hundreds, even thousands of years, ships sailed between China, the Middle East, and Europe. These researchers believe the blue waters here hold clues to the lives and adventures of some of the world's earliest global capitalists.
He said he found early between the two islands when he goes fishing.
That's here. He's been learning how to dive and is set to become Vietnam's first fully qualified underwater archaeologist.
I like diving. We found some interesting shipwreck, so we can understand more clear about our past to raise public awareness about our country history.
I'm thinking the site's over here somewhere.
Yep.
So we'll go down. It should be less than about 3.5 meters of water.
Yep.
This is all uncharted territory. After decades of war and isolation, when Vietnam opened up to the world in the 1990s, it had no funding for maritime archaeology. And it still has little local expertise. That's one of the reasons Mark is here from Australia's Monash University.
He and his team are the guests of Vietnam's Institute for Archaeology.
There's no underwater archaeology done really in Vietnam, and so this is our opportunity to help Vietnamese to investigate and to look after their underwater cultural heritage. So we've been here training these colleagues so that they can eventually do this work for themselves. Might need to double bag it, Hugh.
After just two dives, Hugh is excited about his finds.
I've saw a lot of coral, fish, and potteries.
So what it looks like is a shipwreck has happened here. You can immediately see just colour differences between this yellow body stuff and this red terracotta. This very dark grey. This looks like Tran Dynasty, which is 13th century. That's really exciting.
Back on dry land, in the tourist town of Hoi An, Mark is scouring the market. The souvenir shops are heaving with finds. The distinctive faded blue pots from medieval Vietnam, Chinese Ming ceramics with piercingly bright paintwork. Some appear to be from unrecorded wrecks. He's worried that as Vietnam opens up further, treasure hunters are getting their hands on the material first.
The sad thing for me as an archaeologist is that this material gets dispersed and there's no way that you can see entire collections anymore. And that decreases the importance of the wreck. It decreases the significance of the collection because the collection is no longer complete.
For archaeologists like Mark, this is a matter of urgency. If they can study these pieces of history, they believe they might unlock the untold story of hundreds of years of international commerce. The evidence of possibly huge flows of Asian trade may be lying here, hidden just beneath the surface.
That's the BBC's Samanthi Dissanayake.
Good afternoon. Checking Valley traffic. Watch out for accidents on the 51 southbound at Union Hills Drive. Also, I-17 northbound, some problems there. A collision at Glendale. Also another at Camelback, and that accident at Camelback's causing a pretty heavy backup for a few miles. Valley weather should be clear tonight with overnight lows in the lower to mid-40s. Currently under partly cloudy skies, it is 59 degrees. Quick news update starting on Monday. Arizona must allow young immigrants known as Dreamers the right to apply for driver's licenses. That's the latest order from a federal judge after a two-year legal battle. We'll have more coming up on All Things Considered.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and stories from around the country and across the globe. With the help of reporters and producers around the region and around the world, we're mixing the stories and news to keep you up to date and entertained.
KJZZ is supported by the West Valley Symphony's holiday season concert with festive sounds of Hanukkah and Christmas this Sunday at the Valley Vista Performing Arts Center in Surprise. Details at westvalleysymphony.org.
It's been called the Citizen Kane of bad movies.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
The Room is a low-budget film phenomenon that started in L.A. and has grown to cult status on par with the Rocky Horror Picture Show. But what's become of the actors in the now infamous flick?
Oh, hey, guys.
Oh, hi, Danny.
One of them lives right here in Phoenix. Fans will know Phil Haldeman as Tommy Wiseau's next-door neighbor, Denny.
Denny, do you have something else to do?
I just like to watch you guys.
He's now working on a new creative project that reflects on his unpredictable journey to silver screen stardom. Phil, the main reason we've got you here is to talk about your days in Hollywood, which you've got in a series, you write about in a series of comic books.
It's a series of 10 comic books. I haven't finished them yet, but basically they're autobiographical. They're about my life in Hollywood as a struggling actor. Generally, it's about my experiences shooting on a cult film called The Room. In addition to all the crazy, wacky, zany stuff that just happened to me out there while I was living out there.
Okay, so what made you decide you wanted to even give it a shot in Hollywood in the first place?
Oh, you know what? I just, I was a theater kid at Greenway High School when I was growing up, and I just got the bug, and I knew that, freshman year in high school, I knew I wanted to go, so I went to ASU. I graduated, and like a month or two after I graduated, I was gone. Everything was in my car, and I was living off of Sunset and Western,
Okay, but what kind of expectations did you have? And obviously, I'm sure in the comic books you write about where those expectations went, but how did it start?
Well, I mean, I really did want to, I wanted to be, interestingly enough, I wanted to be a serious actor. And the irony is that I ended up being in a movie that everybody says is the worst movie of all time. Bad acting, bad directing, bad script, but, you know, let life take it where you will, you know what I mean?
Give people who have not heard of The Room or they've just heard it in vague sort of references, what is it? How did you get involved in it? And when people say it's the worst movie, what does that mean even?
Well, you know, I went through about five auditions with the director, Tommy Wiseau, who's really kind of this off-the-wall, mysterious-type character, that he's part of the draw of this movie, The Room. And, you know, we shot the film. All kinds of weird things happened. And, you know, within like a couple of weeks of being on the set, we all knew, all the actors knew that this probably wasn't going to go anywhere. And then when we actually saw it premiere in L.A., we knew even more at that point that this was like really, it may have been the worst movie ever made at the time, but we didn't knew it. No, we just knew it was not going to be seen because people would probably hate it. And then it just took off after a year or two after that.
What happened to the acting career after that?
I came back because I left Hollywood because it's a tough lifestyle, and all my friends had left at the time, and I was, you know, it just wasn't something I wanted to do anymore. And then I got involved, and then I decided, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I came back. So I decided to go back to ASU, but I did continue, I do still act occasionally. It just takes the right project, I guess, you know?
All right, so tell us about the comic book. What's the premise?
It's going to be my life in Hollywood as a struggling actor. I think it's something that a lot of people that ever wanted to act or even tried to act professionally will really relate to. But it's set to the background of The Room, pretty much. You know what I mean? So you'll see all the characters that everybody loves on the screen. You'll see Mark and Tommy Wiseau, or should I say Johnny and Lisa, and all the characters. You know, they'll be there, you know, because people are interested in that. You know what I mean?
You're my favorite customer.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Phil Haldeman will be signing issues of his comic book series My Big Break tonight at Film Bar before a screening of The Room.
You may have seen a lot of pop-up lots around town advertising local Christmas trees, but many of these evergreens actually come from the Pacific Northwest. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins set out to find a real Arizona Christmas tree.
When it comes to the holiday season, I usually feel a little like Charlie Brown.
I just don't understand it. Instead of feeling happy, I feel sort of let down.
But this year, I'm trying to get more into the spirit. I decided to get a Christmas tree, but I don't want a plastic tree from the store or an imported tree from a parking lot. The National Forest Service actually sets aside a number of trees each year for people to cut, but this seemed counterintuitive, so I called a horticulturist at Boyce Thompson Arboretum. Kim Stone says the practice is actually part of a fire suppression effort to thin out smaller trees.
I think many people might feel guilty about going out and cutting a tree, but if you think about it, an acre that's being treated can have hundreds, if not a thousand, small trees taken from each acre. So when you go out and cut your one little tree, you're really hardly making a dent, and you're certainly not doing anything negative.
After resolving my guilt, Stone did have one warning. Don't expect the bushy, full trees you see at the store. Those have actually been sheared to produce the robust, healthy look that we all covet.
So that's the first maybe disappointment people will find when they go out in the wild. It's the kind of tree that you're going to bring home and it's going to look kind of funky, but you're going to say, hey man, I cut this myself.
Knowing what to look for, I got in my car and headed for higher ground.
Driving north on Highway 87 out of Phoenix, the elevation starts to change right at the entrance to the Tonto National Forest. You can see the mountains rising in the distance, and this morning they're shrouded with clouds. After a beautiful hour and a half drive, I arrived at the Payson Ranger Station. Angie Rodriguez with the Forest Service sold me a $15 permit and showed me where to go.
We have your tag right here for any species up to 10 feet tall. You are free to cut your tree down in any of the harvest area, which is the shaded gray on both sides of this map. So any tree that looks like it's going to make a good Christmas tree for you would be fine.
Permit in hand, I drove north for several miles until I saw a promising sight on the side of the road. Two muddy, smiling boys coming out of the forest with pine trees hoisted over their heads.
So what do you got here?
A Christmas tree, an 8-footer.
Ethan Thurman beams with pride looking at the tree. His dad, Ryan, says it's a new holiday tradition for their family.
You know, the drive up together, we watched a Christmas movie in the car on the way up, and then spending an hour and a half hunting and cutting down your tree, and then we're going to go have lunch together. And then it's a real special day just to be together as a family. And again, that sense of using your hands and, you know, having to spy it out, it's a lot more exciting than just going to a Christmas tree shop and getting a tree.
After getting some pointers from Ethan, I wandered the forest for about an hour until finally I came into a bit of a clearing, and the sun is shining on what appears to be about a 5-foot-tall pine tree. There's even holly growing around the base of it. That's got to be a sign. I cleared some old growth out of the way with a hatchet so I could get at the trunk with my saw. Now that I've got it down, I'm just going to trim off some branches and make sure I can fit it in my car for the trip back to Phoenix. It's not very big, and the branches are kind of sparse, but with a little tinsel and ribbon, it'll suit my one-bedroom apartment just fine. I think Linus would approve.
I never thought it was such a bad little tree.
It's not bad at all, really. It just needed a little love. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you'd like to get your own tree, there are still permits available at the Payson Ranger Station, the Tonto National Forest, and cutting is allowed until Christmas Eve.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show. Arizona's water use goes back to the future. Baby boomers are changing how we deal with funerals, and we'll take our best shots.
This show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, Aubrey Abril are the digital team. The managing editor, Al Macias. Our executive producer is the invincible one, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about some good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD, a service of Rio Salado College. Thank you so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.